Good morning. Oh, come on, you can do better than that. Good morning. That's more like it. It's good to see you. I'm glad that you're here. Several years ago, I'm not sure exactly when it was, or I can't remember exactly where we were headed. But Donna and I think had the boys with us at the time, they were small, traveled down, I think, to Corpus Christi, Texas, from where we lived, and went south of Kerrville and a little northwest of San Antonio, where there was a small town at the crossroads of highways, state highways 16 and 173. That town's name is Bandera. They have a sign entering town that has some words on it that will tell you a lot about what kind of town it is. Those words indicated, I'm paraphrasing for propriety's sake, that they thought that town was a little piece of heaven, so not to drive through it like Gehenna. The town has roughly 173 folks. I looked it up according to the 2010 census. And while driving through that little town, at least that's where I think we were at the time, we saw a church sign. It was not one of these marquee signs. It was the sign for a church that said, Saints Peter and Paul Catholic Church. Donna quipped that she guessed they could not rob Peter to pay Paul for their tithes. I remarked, after having seen the sign entering town, that indeed it must be a rough place if it took two saints to manage it. Those things lead me to this. I greatly respect and admire the Apostle Paul. His stellar conscience, as manifested in Acts 23 and verse 1, just astounds me. Where he said that he had never violated his conscience, that he had lived his life in all good conscience. I don't know about you, but I can't say the same. I violated my conscience many times by doing what I knew to be wrong. Through weakness, through wrong desires, through downright rebellion. Many times I've done what I knew to be sinful anyway. I respect and admire the Apostle Paul's tenacity, his never quit spirit. In Acts, the 14th chapter, you'll find him in Lystra, where some Jews from Antioch came down and stoned him outside the city and left him for dead. From verses 19 through 22 and toward the end of that reading in Acts 14, you will notice that he arose and entered the city. He went right back to town and the next day went to Derbe to preach there. He's just been stoned and left for dead one day. And the next day, he travels to a new town and it does exactly the same thing that got him stoned in the last one. I would have probably quit or at least taken a sabbatical. I respect and admire Paul's insight and his knowledge. In Ephesians, the 3rd chapter in verse 3, he says that when you read, you can understand my insight into the mystery of Christ. That's Ephesians 3 and verses 3 to 5, somewhere along in there. I think I was actually quoting from verse 4 of that text. When you read, you can understand my insight into the mystery of Christ. Think about that statement. Paul's knowledge and Paul's insight into the mystery of Christ among men surely must be unsurpassed. I know this to be true generally, that when we read, we can understand what he understood. But when I read, sometimes some of the things that he wrote hundreds of times, I'm still not sure I get it. And in that regard, I tend to agree with Peter when he remarked in 2 Peter 3 and verse 16 concerning some of the things that Paul wrote, that they are hard to understand. So the point is, I have great respect and admiration for the Apostle Paul, but I just don't really relate to him. I don't know about you. But there were two saints mentioned on that sign, and the other was Peter. By the way, I think Indianapolis has a Catholic church that is also Saints Peter and Paul. So I don't know what that says about the combination of Indianapolis and Bandera, but you take that for what it's worth. But the other saint that was on that sign was Peter. And as I look at the life of Peter, and especially his life during the time of which he was with Christ, I relate to that man. I get Peter because either I'm a lot like him or he's a lot like me. In Matthew, the 16th chapter, we understand that Peter sometimes spoke before he really thought. There was an impetuousness not only to his words but also to his actions. We'll talk about the actions in a few moments, but just think about what's going on here in Matthew 16 when Jesus in verse 13 gathers the disciples together and he asks them, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And who speaks up first? Peter's there. And in this case, he's got the right answer. He says, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus responds and says to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And Peter's got to be beaming at this point. He jumped in there with what he thought was the right answer, and he was spot on. And Jesus praises him for that. And further says that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. Not Peter, but the confession that he's made that Jesus is the Christ. And he says, and the gates of Hades shall not overpower it, and I will give you the keys of the kingdom. He didn't give them just to Peter. He gave them to Peter and the other apostles as well, as evidenced on Acts chapter 2. But he says, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you shall bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven, and whatever you shall loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. Then he warned the disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Christ. And that was probably okay with Peter because he's just got a gold star. But that speaking before he spoke didn't always turn out so well. Drop down in the same text to verse 21. Where it says, from that time Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him saying, God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you. Don't misunderstand. Peter's motives were entirely good from his perspective and understanding. He didn't want anything bad to happen to Jesus. This was the Messiah. He's just confessed that fact. And so he is not only vowing his devotion to Jesus as that Messiah, but pleading that he might be allowed to be aidful in his protection. He doesn't want anything bad to happen to Jesus. God forbid it, Lord. This shall never happen to you. But Jesus turns to Peter and says, get behind me, Satan, for you are a stumbling block to me. For you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's. Wow. From the penthouse to the outhouse pretty quickly there, right?
He just got that gold star by speaking out quickly and brashly, but with the right answer. And now when he tries to assert his devotion and his allegiance and his desires, he says, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block." Well, that's what happens when we sometimes speak before we think. But I got to tell you, I can relate to Peter. I've been there. I've done that. Sometimes even in Bible classes, I say things and, man, that sounds good. That was profound. And the next time I jump in there and what a dumb thing to say. The next verse says exactly the opposite. Sometimes Peter's impetuous speech left him just sounding silly. Do you remember in John 13 when Jesus was washing the disciples' feet and he came to Peter and Peter says, "Oh no, not me. You're not washing my feet." And Jesus says, "If I don't wash your feet, you have no part with me." And then Peter says, "Well, then wash me all over." And he's trying again to think and to sound, and I think is genuinely dedicated to the Christ and wants so hard to please him, like that little puppy he wants to please so badly. But how did that work out in John 13? Jesus says, "No, Peter. You're already clean. If you've bathed, all you need is your feet washed." That's not the point. The point was service. Humbling oneself. And thus far, Peter hasn't been real good at that. And even by John 13, he still really hasn't gotten there. But what I'm trying to say is that sometimes he spoke before he thought, and I can relate to Peter in that way. I'll tell you another way that I can relate to Peter. It's found in Matthew again in the 14th chapter. Just back up a couple pages from our text to Matthew 14. You know this story. We're not going to read it. But this is when Jesus has heard that John the Baptist was killed. The multitudes have been thronging all after him, wanting to be healed and have their demons cast out. He's fed them. He wants to go be by himself alone. He's ordered the disciples away. They cross the Sea of Galilee in a boat. The storm comes up in the night. Jesus comes to them walking on the water. And then there's Peter. He says, "Lord, if it is you," because they were all afraid. They thought it was a ghost. And Peter's the one who speaks up and says, "Lord, if it's you, command that I come to you walking on the water." What a bold, brash thing to say. If we didn't know the story already, we might not really suspect how Jesus would respond to that. But Jesus says, "Come on." Look at the text. Matthew 14, verse 28. "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And Jesus says one word, but it has an exclamation point at least in the New American Standard Version. "Come." And Peter got out of the boat. Where are the other 11? They're still in the boat. They didn't suggest this. No, that impetuous, brash Peter did. And he's climbing out of the boat. And he's walking on the water and coming toward Jesus. He wanted to be like Jesus. He wanted to walk on the water, enough to propose it, enough to get out of the boat himself, and even enough to do it for a while. And then, as you know, he took his eye off the goal. The text says that he saw the wind. Well, to see the wind, you have to see the waves. And you see the wind blowing these waves and the water splashing about. And so he sees the wind and the waves and he's taken his eye off the goal. The wind and the waves didn't tell him to come. They said, "Don't come." But in faith, Peter got out of the boat and was walking on the water, walking right across the storms of life, as long as he had his eye on the goal. But then, what happened? Peter
like I often do, allowed his fears to overcome his faith. He saw the winds and the water, and his mind said, this isn't logically possible. This isn't physically possible. Even though his faith had said, oh yes it is, and was allowing him to do it. The storms of life began to make him afraid because he took his eye off the goal, which was the source of his faith and the source of his strength. Verse 30, seeing the wind, he became afraid. He allowed his fears to overcome his faith. I get that. I've been there. I've done that. I've never tried to actually walk on the water. Although there was one time I did everything I could to avoid falling in some very cold water, and I was quite unsuccessful at it. But it didn't take me long to get out either. But he allowed his fears to overcome his faith. The third thing I want you to think about with regard to Peter is that he let his confidence exceed his abilities. Look with me in Matthew 26. In Matthew, the 26th chapter and verse 31 of that text, this is after Jesus has instituted the Lord's Supper. This is after they've sung the hymn and they've gone out onto the Mount of Olives. And Jesus said to them, you all will fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike down the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. But Peter, you know, I didn't do this. I should have. I should have done, looked it up in my Bible program and seen how often the word but preceded Peter. Because I have a feeling that they're going to go together a lot. So we see, but Peter, what this time? Peter answered and said to him, verse 33, although all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away. And Jesus said to him, truly I say to you, this very night, before a cock crows, you shall deny me three times. Verse 35 could have begun with, but Peter, it doesn't. Peter said to him, even if I must die with you, I will not deny you. Peter's not alone in this. The last sentence there of verse 35, the other disciples said the same thing. But the text is focusing on Peter. He was so very confident that he would never deny Jesus or that he would never fall away from him. But when the rubber met the road, so to speak, he did both. In Matthew, the 26th chapter and verse 69, beginning and going down through verse 69 through 75 are the verses. We see that denial of Peter. That when he was to be identified with the Christ as being from Galilee, oh no, not me. Oh yes, you're one of them. Your accent gives it away. No. And the third time when they said, yes, I know you're one of them. You're one of those Galileans, the disciples of Jesus. He cursed and he swore and he said, no, not me. And then as has often happened in my life, as soon as I've made the decision, either consciously or subconsciously, to go against what I know to be right, to violate that conscience, I'm immediately reminded of what I've done. In this case, verse 74 says, immediately a cock crowed. In Luke 22 and verse 62, Luke's account says and adds to this that the Lord looked, turned and looked at Peter. Can you imagine what that look must have felt like? I think I've seen it. not directly, not personally, don't misunderstand me. But because I've done things of which I'm ashamed and immediately was brought to my senses by the knowledge of what I had done, I saw that look. Peter let his confidence exceed his abilities. I want you to think with me for a moment. Do you relate to Peter as well as I? Are you prone to speak before you think? It usually doesn't work out very well for us, does it? If you or if I would just stop and think about a couple of things. Is what I'm about to say true? Do I know it to be true? Or am I just repeating something that somebody else has told me? Is what I'm about to say helpful? Is this going to be an encouragement to someone else? Is this going to give them information that they need in some way? And even if numbers 1 and 2 are there, am I the right person to be saying this at this time? If we would stop and think about those three things, I don't know about you, but I'd probably do a much better job of fulfilling what Ephesians the 4th chapter says that I should. In Ephesians the 4th chapter, the text there says, let no unwholesome word, this is Ephesians 4 verse 29, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment, that it may give grace to those that hear. Doesn't that verse contain all of the things that we've just been talking about? Is it true? Is it helpful? And even if so, am I the one who needs to be saying it right now? Colossians, the 4th chapter, would add to that with these words. Let your speech, verse 6, Colossians 4, verse 6, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how to respond to each person. If I stop and think about, is it true? Is it helpful? Is it for me to say right now? I can be a little less like Peter in some of the negative ways. And so can you. Have you allowed your fears to overcome your faith? For me, the answer is all too often. But the solution is, again, twofold. Build your faith. Where does your faith come from? Faith comes from the Word of God. We've got so many people that don't understand this. They think faith comes from inspirational stories or from self-esteem or from a variety of... No, faith comes from the Word of God. Knowing and understanding the Word of God. So if our fears are overcoming our faith, our fears are too big or our faith is too small, increase our faith. Lord, help my unbelief. So either number one, we need to build our faith, and number two, we need to stop looking at the wind and the waves and keep our eye on the goal. We need to look, in the language of 2 Corinthians chapter 4, not at the things which are seen. We can all look around our lives and see family members with cancer. People that we love and in whom we have confidence cheating on their spouses. We can see our jobs being lost, or our finances being depleted. We can find all sorts of things to be fearful about if we take our eye off that which is our faith, Christ, His Word, and start watching the wind and the waters. Are your fears overcoming your faith? Then look with me at 2 Corinthians, the 4th chapter, for just a second. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, he says in verse 16, "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying," that's true for all of us, "yet our inner man is being renewed day by day." How is that inner man renewed? By a couple of things. Realize that momentary light affliction, and that's anything and everything that we experience in life, it's momentary and it's light affliction. Oh, you don't know what's going on. It doesn't matter what's going on in your life. That's momentary because your life is temporal, and those things going on in your life that are causing all the winds and the waves, they're temporary too. And they're also light in the comparison that he's making here. In verse 17, he says, "For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory, far beyond all comparison." These things that we go through in life that become our fears that consume us pale in comparison to the eternal weight of the glory that we receive in heaven. So it doesn't matter what we're going through or how bad it is. I'm not trying to lessen those things. I understand their severity. I'm trying to change our perspective about them to be sure that our fears don't overcome our faith. Now look at what he says finally in verse 18. "For while we look not at the things which are seen," that's the waves and that's the water, that's the things that cause us fear in this life, "we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, which is Jesus Christ sitting at the right hand of God, having finished His course, having completed His role in our salvation and in our overcoming of this life. He sits at the right hand of God, making intercession on our behalf and pleading with us to follow Him in faith. He says, 'Come.'" The same way He said, "Come," to Peter on the water, He says to you and I, "Come join me here." And when one who suffered and died on the cross as He did looks at our fears and the things that allow, that make, in our minds at least, the winds and the wave to overpower our faith here, He says, "You haven't shed blood in your resistance to sin. Keep your eye on me and come forward. Walk across those waves. Walk across those sea billows to me." He told them in John 14, "I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, there you may be also." That's what He wants us to do. He wants us to come. Thirdly, have you, like me, let your confidence exceed your abilities? The problem is location. You know, realtors tell us it's location, location, location. Well, the problem with this is location as well. The problem is that when our confidence exceeds our abilities, we're placing confidence in the wrong location. Our track record is not real good, is it? Romans, the 3rd chapter, tells us that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Jesus is the one source and location of our confidence, and it has to be that way. He's got the track record to prove it. He overcame all temptations, and our confidence must be placed in Him rather than in ourselves. Look at one passage with me from Hebrews, the 12th chapter. In Hebrews 12, verse 1, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." How do we do that? What does verse 2 say? fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith. The word that's translated as author could also be translated as captain. It's one who goes forth and prepares the way. He's not just saying he's the writer of our salvation. He's the one that blazed the trail and made it easier for us to follow because he succeeded. He got over the winds and the waves of life all the way to the right hand of God. That's where he wants us to be. But I got to tell you, and I just have a minute or two left, Peter's most enduring characteristic, and the one that I and perhaps you need to emulate the most, is that he did not allow past failures to keep him from future success. He spoke before he thought often. He allowed his fears to overcome his faith occasionally. He let his confidence exceed his abilities to the point that he denied the Lord three times after saying adamantly that he wouldn't. But he got back up and he tried to do better the next time. In Luke, the 22nd chapter in verse 31, Jesus says to him, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And you, once you have turned again." What does that mean? "Peter, I know you're going to fail. And once you turn again, strengthen your brothers." Who is it we see on the day of Pentecost? Who is it we see in Acts chapter 1 standing up before the group and saying, "Judas has gone his own way, but Peter's still there. Yes, he sinned. He denied, but he's still there. He didn't quit. He didn't give up. He got right back up and said, we need to pick a replacement. There's work to do." And then in Acts chapter 2, he's the one that the text follows when he stood up. He took his stand with the 11, but I don't know about you, but I can't help but imagine Peter in the forefront of this. He got back up. However many times you and I fail to think before we speak, to allow our fears to overcome our faith, or to let our confidence exceed our abilities, we got to get back up, and we got to try better, and we got to try harder. Jesus will help us, and God will bless us. What about you this morning? Are there things that you need to look at, take to heart, do differently, do better? Do you need to become a child of God for the first time? To put on Christ in baptism and have your sins washed away? Do you need to come back admitting, "I've sinned, I've done wrong, I want to do better. Lord, help my unbelief"? We can help you this morning. You come while we stand and while we sing.